All right, good afternoon. How's everybody doing? Oh, wait a minute. One more time. How's everybody doing? Now we're talking. Excellent. I'm going to warn you right now, I got about 6 days of content I'm trying to squeeze into 75 minutes. So we're going to get right into this, and we're going to get moving. My name is Jeff Woolsey. I'm a principal program manager in the Windows server world. I've been working on a variety of technologies, software-defined computing, for a very, very long time. It is a super pleasure to be here. Today, I want to talk about introducing Windows Server 2016 into your environment. So when I was thinking about this session, there were a number of things I wanted to really get across. One, I want you to understand how to prepare for Windows Server 2016 in hybrid cloud. Two, I wanted to call out technologies that are driving the state of the art in security, software-defined compute, storage, and networking. Three, and it's an important one, I wanted to highlight areas where there are hardware requirements. Okay? There are a whole bunch of really awesome new capabilities in Windows Server 2016, and I'm not going to mix words. It's not going to run on your 5-year-old server. It's not going to run on your 3-year-old server. You want shielded VMs? Awesome. But guess what? We do need some latest and greatest hardware to do it. So I want to be very clear. I'm going to point out areas where we're going to drive the state of the art. So you may need to keep that in mind when you start budgeting for the next budget cycle. So just want you to be aware of that. And I also want to make sure we clarify any questions about 2016 servicing. So that, I'm going to get right into this because I got, like I said, a ton of content. I think very much of Windows Server 2016 as the server you know and your bridge to the cloud. If you know how to deploy Server 2016, Server 2012 R2, if you know how to deploy Active Directory, Hyper-V, scale-out file printer servers, print servers, fax servers, all that good stuff. Yes, I still said fax server. It's still in there. If you know how to deploy those, guess what? You'll know how to deploy them on 2016. But at the same time, we're putting a whole bunch of new technologies in there that have come from Azure, stuff that has actually started in server and gone to Azure, and we're bringing more and more capabilities on premises that you can use for the first time ever that have only existed in Azure. So, one of the questions I get right off the bat, and I actually wanted to actually talk about some technologies that I'm not sure how much they're being covered. There are actually a bunch of features in 2016 that I'm not even sure if people are still aware of, because we introduced them way back in Technology Preview 1, and have been in there, but have kind of been overshadowed as we've released newer and new technologies, previews with newer and newer technologies in them. So we're running older 2008 DCs and are embracing a hybrid cloud infrastructure. How does Server 2016 fit in? What new features should be aware of in Windows Server 2016 DCs? Let's get into that. Active Directory. Active Directory isn't normally an area I play, but there was something that really caught my eye in here in terms of features that's going into Active Directory. So, at its core, what is a DC? It's a server that responds to security authentication requests, but it also has an extremely mission-critical function that is constantly overlooked. And if I gave you a list and said, give me 10 guesses, you probably wouldn't get it. It's actually one of the super sexiest things in a domain controller, and that's the time server. Now, you're thinking, Jeff, what are you talking about? Well, the time server is actually one of those things, like I said, it's actually part of the DC that most people tend not to think about, but it's actually very and very important, and here's why. As we start to move to more and more distributed applications, suppose you've got an application someone's trying to access on the west coast of the US, trying to access on the east coast of the US, trying to access in London, and trying to access in Japan all at the same time. What if those things aren't actually synchronized? What if they're off by, say, 30 seconds here, a minute there? And guess what? You actually have folks working on the same tables and the same databases or the same documents. Uh-oh. Who wins? So all of a sudden, the importance for time synchronization becomes really, really obvious. I know this because we talk to our friends in Azure, and they're like, oh my gosh, yes. This is actually a very critical function that really nobody tends to think about. So what's interesting about the time server is, in the world of compliance and regulatory, this is really important. Show of hands, how many of you work in the financial industry or have financial customers, Wall Street, government? Yeah? Okay. You're going to want to pay attention to this. Here's why. Oh, and by the way, any of you do network management? Any of you use? Yeah. That's all based on time as well. Network accelerators? Yep. Trading systems? Yes. This is all where time server is critical to all of these things. In the US, on Wall Street today, they actually allow a full second skew between UTC. Which means that Wall Street traders that are doing, you know, lots of transactions, know they can do a lot of transactions in a whole second. Yeah. Wall Street folks finally realized, yeah, we need to close this little hole. So regulatory, they have actually closed it. They have actually reduced it from a full second of skew that was allowed to less than 50 milliseconds, which actually is still quite a bit of skew that they allow you from the time to UTC. In Europe, they've actually already said, you guys are nuts. That's way too high. They've actually already gone down to less than a millisecond. So they've already taken it a step further in European exchanges. In Windows Server 2000, in previous to Server 2016, so 2012 R2 and back, if you needed to get less than 50 milliseconds, you would require third-party hardware to do it. Out of the box, wouldn't do it. We'd be in triple digits. So we couldn't meet that requirement. We looked really long and hard at this in Windows Server, and we realized we had some work to do. So again, this is one of those things you probably didn't know that was actually happening. A couple things about time sync standards. There are two really big ones. There's the Precision Time Protocol, PTP. PTP2 is the current version. It's hardware-based. There's actually a version 1 and a version 2. It's important to know they actually have different hardware requirements, which actually made a lot of people very upset because they bought a whole bunch of hardware to support PTP1. Then PTP2 came out, and they said, oh, by the way, you'll need new hardware. So you'll find a mix of both still out there. Then there's NTP. NTP3 is the latest release version. NTP4 is in draft. But this is software. And this is what we've been using in Windows Server since way back, go back to the 2000 world. Now, we've upgraded the time server. Actually, we've done this quietly over many releases. But the important thing is we've never changed the protocol. Because if we change the protocol, then, oh my goodness, that would just wreak havoc with all of the devices connected. So it's very much sticks with the protocol. But we have made improvements to the algorithms behind that. In Server 2016, we've done that yet again. We've made some very big algorithmic improvements. On top of that, we actually looked at the virtualization layer in Hyper-V. Hyper-V has synchronization in the guest integration components between the host and the guest. We've actually done a lot of work on this in the past, but since we were doing this work for time sync standards, we said, ooh, we want to look at this even further, and we found a number of areas where we could make some really awesome optimizations in the Hyper-V protocol. Now, it's important to note, this has nothing to do with physical machines, only with how Hyper-V talks to the guests and does time. The important thing to understand is, again, there are no protocol changes. So there's no disruption to your infrastructure when you deploy this. So now, like I said before, US is down to 50 milliseconds, Europe is down to less than 1, but now with Windows Server 2016, you can actually do all of this in software. Now, big, huge, monster caveat, of course, make sure, of course, whatever the source clock is a good one. Okay, the old axiom, garbage in, garbage out, still applies. If you have a horrible master clock for us to sync from, it doesn't really matter. So as long as you got that covered, we're going to do a great job in software for you. So what does this really look like? Well, in terms of latest generation NTP time synchronization, yeah, notice, we're no longer talking milliseconds. We're actually talking microseconds. So we've done a whole bunch of changes in our algorithms, better statistical processing, improved error correction. In Hyper-V, we did some work here that made it crazy accurate. We're talking now tens of microseconds. So you want the absolute best time sync, period, on any virtualization platform. I'm telling you right now, we've done a massive amount of work to make sure that this just works. On top of that, we loaded up some big servers and put a massive load on the systems to see, okay, if we absolutely crush a system, just absolutely put a ton of VMs on it and crush that system, how will that affect the time skew? We were still less than 100 microseconds. So very excited about that work. There is a new version of the VM integration component protocol. Guess what? We just automatically take care of that for you. And then we did some things to better improve monitoring to make it easy for you to determine accuracy and do remote monitoring. So high precision time sync in the box in 2016. And just so you understand at a very high level what this looks like, again, give us a good clock, okay? As long as you give us a good clock, give us 2016 as your time master, okay? Very minimal skew there. Then it comes down to your domain controllers or potentially non-domain Windows clients. Still 50 microsecond skew here. Then you could actually get to further domain members, domain controllers, and your Hyper-V hosts. And you're still doing this and beating the requirements needed by financials and compliance and regulatory. So one of the questions I get is, okay, Jeff, so what do I have to do to actually deploy this internally. Are you telling me I have to replace everything with 2016 to make all this work? In actuality, I think of this as there's a good, better, and best involved. There's a phased approach. If you just go with good, if you just say, you know what, I'm going to create, my 2016 will be my master domain time controller, that'll give you good. Because what it'll do is it'll make sure that that is the one that's providing the master sync, has all the improvements, and even if you're feeding down to your 2012 R2 domain controllers, they will still see an improvement because they're getting it from a better source. A better thing to do would be to actually upgrade all of your DCs to 2016, and you would actually get then all of the improvements across the board to those servers as well. And then finally, best would not only be to upgrade all your DCs, but would actually be to make sure that all of your clients are running Windows 10 Anniversary Update. Because this, actually, the code changes in here were actually went into Windows 10 Anniversary Update as well. The important thing is, you don't have to go rip and replace. You can do this over time, and as you gradually phase this in, you're just going to get the better benefits. So, really cool feature, built in 2016. We actually delivered this, surprisingly enough, in TP1 last year. And very few people know that it exists, but I can tell you the TAP customers that we were working with that actually were using this and testing it out loved it. All right, one important thing to note, if you're just going to do the good method, which is just upgrade the domain time sync master, there is one thing you have to know. You need to go configure the Windows time server for that 2016 to declare, I am the time master. Otherwise, potentially another DC could try and claim it's the time sync master and you're not going to get those benefits. So I included all of these things here. I got a bunch of links in this, so when you guys get the decks, you'll be able to go right to it. In addition, there's a bunch of other nice things in AD. We have an improved sign-on experience. From a security standpoint, we now, of course, have new Azure multi-factor authentication, we have new LDAP support, and we have a ways to authenticate domain-joined devices without the need to supply a password, even from the extranet. So there's a lot of goodness baked in the 2016 domain controllers, and if you haven't taken a look, you definitely should. In addition, DNS security. We also did a number of things to improve DNS security. Response rate limiting to actually help prevent DNS denial of service attacks. DANE support prevents a form of man-in-the-middle of attacks. IP6 root hints and DNS server now supported on Nano. Now, to be clear, that's not AD. AD is not supported on Nano at this time, but DNS is if you wanted to put DNS on Nano. So again, I know we've been talking a lot about some really big ticket items, but there's actually a bunch of things going on in server, probably a level below, that a lot of people aren't aware of, like in Active Directory and DNS. And there's a whole bunch of resources. I like to put lots of links because that way you can get all of these documentation and everything when you guys get the slides. So moving along, we got to get to security. And again, I'm keeping the pace here because I got 18 hours of content. Number one, security, top priority. How many of you guys work on security in your organization? Okay, those of you who haven't raised your hand, you should be raising your hand next time because it's everybody's job. I was actually talking with a gentleman at the booth yesterday. We were having a great chat. He was telling me about things that he does in his infrastructure. And I said, so what part of security do you work on? He goes, oh, I don't have a security team. And I said, wait, no. Everybody is an active member of security. And here's why. And the list goes on. This is just a few. But come on, folks. The attackers are getting worse. They're getting more, more brazen because, honestly, they're probably in their pajamas a couple continents away, not worried that they're going to be prosecuted. And so guess what? We're seeing a lot more attacks on all companies of all shapes and all sizes. In addition, when I think of organizations in the United States that probably have really awesome security, I'd probably think this would be at the top of the list. There's a little organization called the FDIC. They just manage the U.S. economy. Kind of important. Well, they were hacked between 2010 and 2013, and we literally just found out about this a few months ago. I was honestly horrified when I read this. Could not believe this. I'm like, oh, you mean, yeah, that department in the U.S.? That's kind of super important. Again, it's everybody's job, and we all need to up our game because the bad guys are certainly doing that. Now, historically, the network has been seen as the primary attack surface. If you look at a bunch of bad movies in the 90s, they always say, you've got to keep the firewall up. You've got to keep the firewall up. As long as the firewall's up, everything's good. Blah, firewall. Great, great. I'm not saying it's unnecessary, but that's like two-dimensional thinking if that's the only thing you're thinking about when it comes to security. Firewall is the least of my problems anymore. Identity is the new attack surface. Let's be super clear here. I can sit here and try to figure out how to hack someone's firewall, or I can write up some email and get inside your organization like that. Jeff, what are you saying? Well, what I'm telling you is attackers have a number of dangerous weapons. Number one, this thing called a search engine. Okay, I did a search just a few weeks ago, and in less than 10 seconds found this organizational chart. This is a large healthcare company. I actually blurred out the names, and I realized I had the CEO name, so I had to blur that out as well. Here's a full org chart for a health company. Their CEO's there, and the CTO is there, and if you click into there, it links to the director of IT. If I link into the director of IT, I get the full list of everybody it works from. So now I can pretty easily write an email, send an email, and say, hey, by the way, these other people, we're all gonna meet for lunch. Couple things I wanted you to click here, and if I can just get you to click on one of those things and do a phishing attack, guess what? I'm inside your organization. Now you're thinking, oh, Jeff, that's ridiculous. Nobody falls for phishing attacks. Right. Sure they don't. Sure they don't. Just on ours, literally a week or two ago, people actually did research on this. And who did they research? They researched people in the know. Yeah, I'll go click on that. Sure, why not? Oh yeah, it's very real. So one of the things we want to do is we want to make sure that everybody understands the depth now security is getting to and the height that it's getting to. It's not only the guys working, you know, feverishly in the actual IT infrastructure and the guys that are keeping the business running and doing all that wonderful work down there, but it's now a CEO issue. Because the average cost is about $3.5 to $4 million per breach. And the average liability now they're carrying for large corporations is about $500 million in corporate liability for these types of attacks. So one of the things we're doing is we've been focused on a tremendous amount of ways that we can help protect and give you additional layers of protection. And the ones I'm going to focus on today are these ones in arrows. So let's start with a question I received recently from a very large U.S. organization. They said to me, Jeff, I have a bunch of guys in my IT. I've got the director of IT, and I've got the manager of IT. These guys are great. They went with the company 15 years, 20 years. I trust these guys completely. Yes, they are full admins, and you know what? We're good with them, and they're happy to be here, and we have a great relationship, and we hope that they never leave. We're hiring a bunch of new guys right out of college, a bunch of new folks out of college, really, really smart. They'll probably be better than these guys in a few years, but you know what? What they don't have is experience. What they don't have is training. I used to be able to spend a sizable amount of my budget to go get people trained. I don't do that anymore. I just basically throw them in the deep end of the pool and hope they don't break the company. You know what? Is there a way that we could put guardrails on some of these new admins and say, you're an admin, but you know what? You're the SQL admin. You can actually go in and you can monitor SQL and you're the actual admin, but I'm not gonna let you traverse the entire file system. I'm not going to let you, you can't go into the OS, you can't go look into Exchange, you can't go look at VMs, you can only do SQL stuff. And over time, we'll add more capabilities to this person as they grow. Yeah, we think that's a great idea. And one of the areas we've been focusing in on is actually providing better controls for admins. Because really, up until 2016, we always said, well, if you want to limit a user, you got to make them a user. But if they're an admin, by definition, they're God, they can do whatever they want. Well, social engineering is making it far, far easier for folks to get admin credentials, and the bad guys are able to go in and start dropping malware in your infrastructure, and good luck finding them because they look just like you and authenticated people. Pass the hash is a very known and a very real issue where people can not get actual usernames and passwords, but get a hash that they can start processes and actually run and look like they are actual members of your organization. And the admin today has unlimited rights, and usually for unlimited time. It's unbounded. So what we are doing is introducing a number of technologies to help in this security. From a typical admin standpoint, they're logged in as admin, and that means they have all capability for all time. And I don't know how many times we have to say this, but you know, as a server admin, you should absolutely never be logged in as a domain admin or a server admin and be browsing the web. And everybody always shakes their head and they say, yes, we never do that. Of course we never do that, but people do that. So what you really want to do is, I really want to be, if I'm the network admin, I should be logged in as Jeff, regular user doing my email, browsing the web. But when I have to go make a change to the network controller, I should get a temporary elevation to allow me to do what I need to do for an hour, or maybe a half an hour, and a half an hour goes by, and guess what? I'm just magically back to Jeff again. I didn't have to log in or log out. Nope, those privileges were automatically managed for me. So we're doing a number of things to help protect against compromised admin credentials through Credential Guard and Remote Credential Guard. And I don't have time to drill into pass the hash, what the actual issue is with pass the hash. I'm here to tell you it's gone in Server 2016, and it's gone if you're running Windows 10 anniversary update, period. Like, that issue is just gone. You can't do it because we don't provide a hash anymore. It's all encrypted using virtualization-based security. The other two, just enough administration and just in time administration, are ways to actually put limits, logical limits, on an admin. So for example, if you've got that fantastic new admin you just hired, but you're, again, you've given them limited training, you don't want them to break the infrastructure, great, give them role-based access control, limit what they actually can do. You're a SQL admin, fantastic. You can monitor SQL, you can't traverse the file system, you can't actually go play with the firewall right now. When you're with the company for a little bit longer, guess what, we'll actually up those privileges. Maybe you actually can go to the Exchange server, but you can only read. You only get commands using PowerShell. You can't actually add anything new. Great, and we'll add those over time. With just-in-time administration, now we're putting a time constraint. So for example, if I'm the network admin, and I need to make a change to the network firewall, guess what? I actually have to go to my boss, or actually a number of people, and say, folks, would you please elevate my privilege? And then go to a web page. There's actually a workflow involved. And basically, yes, you have it. We'll go ahead and grant you access, which means now we're actually tracking when you were given access, who gave you the access, and how long you had the access. So I go in, I make the change on the network firewall. 30 minutes go by. Oh, man, you know what? I didn't get it finished. All right, I got to go back. Hey, guys, you know what? That change to the network firewall, we all agreed that I should do this morning. I didn't get it done. Now's a point where you can actually have a little chat and say, well, wait a minute. This should have taken you 5 minutes at most. We gave you 30. What's the problem? It was my mistake, it was a dumb mistake, but trust me, I'll get it fixed. Okay, we'll give you one more elevation of privilege to go make that change, but if you come back and didn't get it done, we're gonna back out this change and we're gonna look at what's going on here. So again, I'm providing a process to actually audit while it's happening and make it easy to provide, again, just-in-time controls to your administration. So, that identity manager, and I have to admit right off the bat, this is probably one of the worst acronyms ever at Microsoft, and we've had some doozies. It's MIMPIM, Microsoft Identity Manager Privileged Identity Management, something like that. I can't even remember it is. Well, that's how bad it is. Thank you very much. I'll be here all the week. The important thing is, this is your workflow. So when I go in and I say, you know what, I need that 30 minutes of control, guess what? I go through here, I make the request, and guess what? I have to have a majority vote. So if there's five people, then I need three people to vote. Or maybe I say, you know what, only my manager has to approve this. But basically, we want to make sure that someone is basically saying, okay, we're agreeing with this and you have this temporary elevation. You're not running as admin 24/7, 365 days a year, when most of the time, you're doing things that don't require you to have that elevation of privilege. All right, switching over to virtualization. I have to admit, I love hypervisors. That's one of the reasons I came to Microsoft 14 years ago. Been working on hypervisors and virtualization a long time, and I'll be the first one to tell you, virtualization is fantastic. I love it. I'm also the first one to tell you it's far from perfect. If you go back to sessions I delivered probably in 2005, I'd also be the first person to tell you that virtualization actually creates problems. What? But virtualization's perfect, Jeff. It solves all of our problems. Come on, what are you talking about? No, it really does actually create some problems. The first one, single point of failure. So previous to virtualization, if I had a SQL server running on here, and that SQL server went down, yeah, it was bad, don't get me wrong, but one workload went down. If now this is a virtualization host and it's running 50 VMs and that server goes down, I just lost 50 workloads. Now the good news is, we've all solved this. It's why we have clustering, it's why we have live migration, it's why we have shared nothing live migration, it's why we have storage migration. It's all there, it's all built in, we're all good, fantastic, done deal. The second one, no one has done jack about. Single point of attack. Again, if I have a single SQL server and I can get into that SQL server, whether I'm actually a rogue admin, an admin who actually just had a bad performance review and realized things are going bad, maybe I'm going to quit next week, but I'm going to take some goodies before I walk out the door. Or maybe I'm actually a bad guy who somehow got admin creds. Either one is possible, okay? If it was a single SQL server, yeah, that's bad, but again, it was one workload. If this is a virtualization host, I just got 50 workloads, and guess what? On top of that, you probably have no idea I even took them out the door. On top of that, with virtualization, because we encapsulate everything into just a couple files, I hate to admit this, but we actually make it easier to steal things. This was an unintended consequence. But the process of encapsulating workloads into VMs in just a couple files means, hey, yeah, I get live migration, I get replication. There's a whole bunch of really cool, fantastic value things we deliver in virtualization. But it also means it makes it easy to just drop in a USB stick, copy files over, and walk out the door. So why is this so difficult? Well, there's actually some major challenges here. This is not easy, which is why no one has had a solution for this. Okay? Number one. On any platform, Linux, Unix, VMware, macOS, Windows, by definition, if I am local admin on this server, I am God. I can do anything. For years, I've had people send me email, Jeff, would you just put a virtual TPM in a Hyper-V VM and we'll all be good? And my response was, that's a neat idea. It's completely worthless. Because anything you do to encrypt that VM, I can undo. I am the admin. I am God. You encrypt it, I'll find the keys in memory and decrypt it. Didn't buy me a thing. So that's a huge problem. By the way, this goes back to the dawn of computer science. This is a many, many decade-old problem. Problem number two. Any seized or infected host admins can access guest VMs. The bad guys know this, and they're targeting them with things like phishing attacks. Basically, if I'm a fabric administrator, if I'm a virtualization host admin, if I'm a storage admin, or if I'm a network admin, if I'm any one of those admins, if I do anything to manage the fabric, I can easily own you. This is like no one, I know everyone's kind of like moving in their chair like, oh, is he really saying this? I'm not feeling good. This doesn't make me feel good. Look, I'm just trying to be honest and be transparent because this is something that, like, honestly gets overlooked all the time. If you're a fabric admin, by definition, I can do whatever you want. And again, you're going to tell me you're going to encrypt the VM, and I'm going to laugh because I can decrypt it. So again, any admin can own you. Next, tenant VMs are exposed to storage and network attacks while unencrypted. Yeah, that seems pretty obvious. But it's also important to note that that's both at rest and live and running. You have to handle all of these things. And finally, the fourth one, and probably one of the another very interesting aspect of this, is that it's impossible to identify legitimate hosts without hardware-based verification. What that means is, if I have a server that's running contoso.com, and it doesn't matter what hypervisor it is, it's Hyper-V, it's VMware, it's KVM, it's Xen, and I put in my USB stick, I copy my virtual machine here, and I take it home, and I plug it into my laptop on, again, any hypervisor. I can start it, I can mount it, I can run it, I can do whatever I want. Because the VM doesn't know, do I trust this hardware? There's literally no way to actually identify if this is legitimate hardware. It just says, okay, I'll run. So we looked at this problem, and we said, yeah, this is a really bad problem. And on top of that, there's a couple of scenarios beneath it. Number one, bad guys and admins. Bad guys are targeting admins through phishing attacks, like I already mentioned. They're looking for them in your org chart. If I can just get one admin to click on one phishing thing, maybe I'll send them some email about free tacos on a late Friday night, maybe when they're having a beer bash, maybe one guy will click a phish, and boom, I can get some malware installed. Number two, trusted admin has a bad day. Unfortunately, this happens a little more often than we think. The guy you trusted yesterday just had a bad performance review. He's not going to be with us much longer. He knows this, and you know what? He's going to take some goodies and leave. This actually happened in San Francisco, where the guy who ran, like, the network left. Oh, and by the way, took all the passwords with him. It put him in jail until he gave up the passwords because they couldn't actually manage their network. That's a problem. Last one, inadvertent data leakage. This one actually happens, and this is the one when I talk to CTOs keeps them up nights. This is the whoops moment. This is the, you know, we think we're doing everything right. We've got really good people. Everything's good, but we brought in some new servers. We retired the old servers, and when the old servers went to get retired, they went to a company that's going to recycle them, and they promised that they were going to destroy those hard disks with a hammer, or they were going to degauss them and delete them and do everything according to DoD standards, except they missed one, and it's being sold on eBay right now with credit card information. I have numerous articles on this happening. So you can see there's lots of different scenarios where this is a challenge. And of course, I want to protect against the most dangerous technology ever invented, the USB stick. So, this is what shielded VMs are all about. Shielded VMs can only run on the fabrics for which they are designated. It protects against the rogue admin. I want to be super clear here. I said rogue admin. If you have a conspiracy, if you have two people, I can't protect against that. You've got bigger problems, by the way. But it's literally the rogue admin. Think about the Hunt for Red October, Crimson Tide, or some of those bad movies seen in the 90s where they need to go launch the nuclear missiles. There's always two different people with two different keys, and they're not in the one person can't turn them at the same time. You need two people to do that. Well, that's kind of one of the premises behind what we're doing, shielded virtual machines, and so much more. So, how does this work? This sounds too good to be true. And by the way, live migration doesn't work, right? No, live migration works. Live migration works, shared live migration works, shared nothing live migration works, storage migration works, all those things still work. Because if we had said, oh, by the way, you can have this, but you can't move them anymore, that'd kind of suck, actually. Nope, still works. So, what it means is, if the rogue admin now, if I'm the Hyper-V admin or a virtualization admin or a storage admin, and I happen to get a virtual machine on my stick, and I go home and I plug it in to my laptop or my system at home, all I have is an encrypted blob. Won't start, won't run, because this VM only runs on that fabric over there. All right, let me tell you how it works. So, shielded VMs and guarded fabric. First thing you do is you create a guarded fabric. Let's just suppose for just a moment I have a rack of servers right here. This is my servers, this is my storage, this is my networking, this is everything. All right? Now notice, this is in one trust domain. We're going to call this contoso.com. Second thing we do is we create this thing called the host guardian service. The host guardian service is in a separate trust domain. Listen to me very closely. In a separate trust domain. It has nothing to do with that domain at all. And it's a couple servers sitting over here. In fact, these are probably in a locked cage with two padlocks, not one, two padlocks, and a camera. So you can keep an eye on anybody walking here. Probably what you're doing for your PKI servers, for example. You would treat it the same way. So this thing actually measures and verifies the fabric that you're running your infrastructure on. So the guardian service is attests to the fabric so that you know that it's safe for shielded virtual machines to run. Number three, you create your shielded VMs. So I'm running shielded VMs, and by the way, I can run shielded and unshielded side by side. The thing that's different is a shielded VM can only run on this fabric. It cannot run on another fabric. If I try and live migrate it to a server in this fabric, it's all good. If I try and live migrate it to another server that's not in this fabric, it won't work. We check before we live migrate or make any sort of state change and say, sorry, that's on a different machine that's not in the trusted fabric. You can't do that. And the most important thing is, even a local admin cannot view memory contents. Now you're thinking, Jeff, that's crazy talk. You told me 10 minutes ago that by definition, if I am the admin on this server, I am God and I can do everything, including inspect memory and find all of your key contents. You're right. This is a really hard problem. If there's any point I want to get across is this isn't something that took us an hour or a week or even a year. This is many years of really solid development work to make this happen. So, how does this work? Well, I'm going to highlight three critical technologies that make shielded VMs work. to be very clear here, there is no single silver bullet. You have to do all three. The first thing is this thing called virtual secure mode, VSM. Oh, come on, stop, there we go. So, with virtual secure mode, this is where the keys reside so that when a virtual machine runs, guess what? A local admin can't see it. So here's what happens. When your fabric boots up, the Guardian service actually measures every one of these servers it's booting up. It measures, it hashes, it measures, it hashes, and it knows, you know what? This is all good. No malware has gotten in the boot process. Of course, we have device guard. We have a whole bunch of protections in place to make sure that nothing has gotten in the boot process. And once the server is booted up, great, all done. Next, on each one of these servers, there's a code integrity policy that says only the whitelisted processes can run on here, meaning my Hyper-V processes, my storage processes for the scale-out file server. That's it. If someone tried to do something like hook up a debugger, oh, sorry, that doesn't pass the code integrity policy. That specific host, doesn't pass. You can't run shielded VMs. Also, each shielded virtual machine runs as a protected process, so you actually can't attach process to it like debuggers. By the way, because you can't do that means you can't inspect memory. So now we have actually protected memory of the virtual machines from the admin. Ooh, pretty cool. Now, virtual secure mode, though, somehow when I fire up these VMs and I start up a shielded VM, it's going to look down and say, okay, I can run on Contoso Fabric. It now goes and talks to the Guardian service. The Guardian service says, hold on, let me check your host. Yeah, your host passed the code integrity policy. We've checked there's no debuggers installed. You actually passed the boot process. We measured and attested. You're good. I'm going to hand you the keys now so that you can run. But now you're thinking, Jeff, can't I get those keys? No, because those keys don't exist in the Windows context at all. The Windows kernel doesn't even see those keys. Virtual secure mode is some awesome secret sauce. It's off to the side of the kernel. It's actually a teeny tiny enclave that's managing those keys, communicating directly to the hypervisor. Admin can't see it. Windows kernel can't see it. Windows doesn't even know what's happening. All I know is I now securely have the keys, and I can run those VMs. So virtual secure mode, key to that. Next, good pun. I didn't even think of that. Next, the host guardian service, of course. The host guardian service is this external entity that is verifying the fabric. This is what's actually saying, we trust this fabric. Bad guys didn't get in there, whether they were external or internal. Host guardian service. And by the way, I get this asked all the time. Yes, you can cluster this. You should absolutely, this is a highly available service, absolutely. And like I said, put this in a locked cage with the camera and two padlocks, so you, again, need two keys to get in there. Lastly, we did put a virtual TPM inside of the shielded virtual machine. Let me point out very clearly, the virtual TPM has nothing to do with the hardware. It is purely a software virtualized TPM. It's a software, I shouldn't say virtualized, a software created TPM. And the reason why is twofold. Number one, if it was hardware, then I couldn't live migrate the VM because I'd be tied to hardware. Number two, physical TPMs were never designed with virtualization in mind, so they're actually not the way you want to do it. You do it in software, and through the virtual TPM inside of the guest OS, we can then seal the encryption key for the virtual machine. So, what does this mean from if I'm a hoster, if I'm a tenant, if I'm an enterprise? If I'm a hoster, it means I can say I can protect tenant VMs and their data center from my own admins. Imagine you're a hoster, and yes, you've got regular VMs, but you can also provide an offer that says, folks, if you want to run shielded VMs, you can. Just understand, we won't be able to help you if you have a problem inside of the guest OS, because we can't get inside there either. That's a statement actually a lot of customers want to hear. They want to be able to say, we're in control, because at the end of the day with a shielded VM, the owner is the guest OS owner, not the host admin. As a tenant, as the person who's actually the admin of the VM, it means I can run in the cloud while meeting compliance and regulatory, because guess what? I maintain all the keys. As an enterprise, I can provide strong separation between Hyper-V administrators and sensitive workloads, because again, those admins can't actually get to this. So, with that, I'm actually going to pop on over here. And a number of people I know may have seen this, but I know a bunch of people didn't see this. So I wanted to show you the Shielded VM, Shielded Virtual Machine demo. So first of all, let's pretend I'm a malicious admin. I'm the bad guy. And either I just had a bad review and I'm an internal employee, or I could actually be a bad guy outside of your organization who somehow has storage administrator credentials. I am an admin. Okay? So what do I want to do? Well, I'd like to steal some secrets today. So I'm going to go to my SAN. And you know what? I know that the main controller is already virtualized. So I'm going to go in here. And lo and behold, it's a treasure trove. I can double click on the domain controller. Super hard attack. Whew, that was tough. And you can see here I have the NTDS folder. The NTDS folder has the NTDS.dit, or another way to put it is, that is the entire Active Directory database. That's how easy it was for me to steal that. I'm going to go back over here. I'm going to pop it on my USB stick. I'm going to take it home, and I'm going to brute force attack this for the next few months. Because there are tools out there that will help you do that. And when you do, I'll have something that looks like this. It's a key value pair list. I get all the usernames and all of the passwords. So really, wouldn't it be great if there was a way that we could protect against storage admins, Hyper-V admins, network admins? Yeah, that's what Shielded Virtual Machines is all about. I go to System Center Virtual Machine Manager, and in fact, you can see I've got Domain Controller 1 right here. I have Secure Boot enabled, but I didn't shield it. I did shield my Domain Controller 2. Great, glad to see that. But I didn't shield this one, so let's go and do that. Real difficult here. I'm going to select it and click on the shield button. Whew, tough. Now, one thing I have to do is I have to add the shielding data. Now, this is interesting. I didn't get a chance to talk about this too much yesterday. With the shielding data, what is it? Well, the shielding data is an encrypted lump of secrets created by the virtual machine owner, okay? This is securely delivered to the fabric, not to an admin, not to a human, but to the fabric that these secrets are delivered to the fabric that I can use so I can use my shielded VMs. These secrets include things like the administrator password to log into the VM, an RDP certificate so that I know there's no man in the middle of attack and I actually know that I'm connecting to the virtual machine that I'm deploying. Number three, a list of the fabrics that I'm authorized to run this shielded virtual machine on. So it actually could be multiple fabrics. I've been asked this a number of times. Jeff, I'm worried about DR. Okay, if I'm running in Site 1 in shielded virtual machines and this goes down and I need to come up in Site 2, what do my shielded virtual machines do? That's okay. When you create your shielded virtual machines, say it can run on Fabric 1 and Fabric 2, you're golden. We're all good there. We thought of that. Okay? And the last thing is this thing called a volume signature catalog. The volume signature catalog is really important, for example, if you're working with a service provider. If you want to go to a service provider and you want to deploy a new shielded VM, well, most likely you're going to use a template disk. Well, if I'm the bad guy, the perfect place to put that malware is in the template disk, because it means every time someone uses the template disk, I just deployed some new malware. Sweet. Well, we thought of that too. So what you do is, with the volume signature catalog, you create your template disk and you upload it. Then when you go to deploy it, it actually verifies the integrity to make sure it hasn't been tampered with and nobody has added malware to it. You can see this is a very, very wide attack surface. That's what's in there in terms of the shielding data. Now, actually doing the shielding data, oh, and by the way, I am converting. I would certainly recommend that when you do shielded VMs that you actually deploy a shielded VM from scratch and start there. But if you already have existing VMs, that's why we do the conversion. And it usually takes a few minutes. It really just depends on how much data you need to encrypt. So while that's happening, I'm going to go back over here, and I'm going to go back and attack that other SAN, other domain controller that has been shielded. So if I double-click on this one, you'll see right off the bat I get an error that says, sorry, this drive is BitLocker encrypted. I can't get in there. By the way, I'm the storage admin, and I still can't get in. All right. Let's go back here. And let's see it from the Explorer. You can see, yeah, it's got the golden padlock. And when I double click at it, it says, there are no supported protectors on this drive. What this is saying to me is, I can't decrypt the key to decrypt the volume. So even though I'm logged in as Super Storage Admin, sorry, I'm still out of luck because, again, it's owned by the owner of the guest OS. All right, let's try a different attack vector. Let's go to Hyper-V. Now in Hyper-V, I can select a virtual machine, and if you look down here, we've got a live thumbnail. And if I double click on it, it actually brings me a console connection. That's what I'm used to doing in Hyper-V. Well, if I have a shielded virtual machine, you'll notice there's no thumbnail. That's grayed out. And if I double click on it, sorry, no console connection for you. You've got to use RDP. Why? Because then we're going to verify your credentials. We're going to use an RDP certificate to make sure there's no man in the middle of attack. Again, massive attack surface, and we're thinking of every step along the line. All right, so think about what you've seen here, and a couple other notes to note, a couple other facts about shielded virtual machines. Each shielded virtual machine has a virtual TPM. The virtual TPM is used to actually seal the key that is used to encrypt the shielded virtual machine's disks. In addition, each virtual TPM is unique. Thus, every shielded virtual machine has a unique encryption key. On top of that, as I mentioned before, each shielded virtual machine runs as a protected process. I can't attach processes, means I can't attach debuggers, and I can't inspect memory. So again, we're actually protecting the memory of virtual machines from admins locally in the box. And finally, of course, host integration. No console connections, no PowerShell Direct, no integration component integration in there, no file copy, nope. This is literally a black box. This is about protecting your workloads from host admins. This is what shielded virtual machines are all about. I see a question, I gotta keep going. I'll take questions after, thank you. All right, so with that in mind, I hope you get a little bit of an idea of just how far we've gone with shielded virtual machines and how much we've thought about it. And anybody who tells you, well, I encrypt the disk, honestly, that's laughable. That's nothing, that's worthless. It's a fairy tale. That's Goldilocks. Who cares? That's nothing. You have to do it end-to-end, completely holistic, or I'm going to break you. All right, moving along. From a hardware standpoint, this is important because I'm going to tell you right now, everybody who's come by the booth, I was at the booth yesterday working for a few hours, and there was literally a queue the entire time. And it was great. Please, come by the booth. Love to hear your feedback. A bunch of people ask me, Jeff, what hardware do I need? Because I'm going to make sure that the next time I deploy, I'm using shielded VMs. So get this, everybody. This is the hardware you need. Important thing to note, second-level address translation, SLAT, used to be optional, so you could run on like a 10-year-old server. Okay, we finally cut the cord. You actually have to have extended page tables on an Intel processor or rapid virtualization indexing on an AMD processor. If you have a server that's at least, you know, anywhere recent, it's already on there, so it's not a problem. VTX required. Now, the next two, TPM V2, you notice it says optional, and you'll see VTD says optional. Okay, I actually almost had a fist fight with the PM about this. Here's why it says optional. Okay, I'm gonna tell you right now, to me it's never optional. I am never gonna recommend that you deploy this without a TPM or without VTD. But here's why it is optional. If you wanna test this today, and trust me, everybody I'm talking to is ready to go run home and do a proof of concept right now. If you wanna do that, great. You can do it on the server that you have that doesn't have a TPM. You're not going to get the security, you're not going to get the same level of protection that we offer, and there's a different type of attestation mode we use. Instead of a TPM, we'll actually use Active Directory to do our attestation. The difference is pretty profound, though. It does not protect against host administrator, fabric administrator attacks. Okay, that's a pretty big shift in your security posture, which is why I can't recommend it for production use. If you're doing it for a proof of concept, fine. But when you do go deploy, make sure you got TPM V2, VTD, and UEFI 2.3.1. And the good news is we've been working with all of our partners and they've been shipping this for some time now. So just want to let you know about that. Oh, and I get asked about this all the time. You guys can have the slides and take a look. Long story short, they got nothing. Moving right along. Security. If you want to get started on Jia and JIT, I was already talking about those earlier, to help your administrators, I urge you to do this. We've actually provided free guidance on TechNet, and we've actually done it in a phased approach. If there's a 2 to 4 week plan to quickly mitigate frequently used attacks, There's a 1 to 3 month plan to build visibility and control admin activity. And then there's a six plus month plan that allows you to continue building defenses to be more proactive. All freely available. I urge you to take a look at it. All publicly available up on TechNet. Storage Spaces Direct. Storage Spaces Direct, quite honestly, I'm thrilled out of my mind about. We've been doing a bunch of work with a bunch of partners, and in fact, one of these was recently done with Intel. And one of the things we wanted to show was, what does performance look like? So here's a 16-node failover clustering running VM Fleet. VM Fleet is a publicly available, you can download it off GitHub, bunch of VMs that are running actively under load. It's not some fictitious workloads. It's not doing any I/O and it's just doing memory bound I/O. It's actually doing real I/O. So we've got a bunch of those running, and we're seeing in this 16-node configuration about 100,000 IOPS per server. Not bad. We're running with a 70-30 mix, 70% read, 30% write. I know one of those other guys out there was crowing really loudly that they were able to do 100,000 IOPS per server and that they were able to get, some numbers there. Well, that's just starter numbers. So we said, okay, you know what? Let's raise the bar a little bit. Let's actually start to unleash the safeties on this. So we started throwing some more workloads at it. And we went from that to 2.9 million, 3 million, 3.2 million IOPS, over 200,000 IOPS per server. Pretty awesome, pretty sweet, with less than a millisecond latency. And by the way, in terms of Hyper-V CPU, we're using less than about 5% CPU utilization per host because we're using RDMA, which means we get a ton of this performance for free. All those other platforms that don't have hard RDMA in their platform, they're sucking up at least two of your cores per server to do all of that replication. By the way, they don't like to tell you that. RDMA is critical to making hyperconverged work, but we're actually still not done. The guys in storage kept going. They kept pushing it even harder, and they said, we're really gonna take the safeties off this time. All right, 3 million was pretty awesome, but how high can we really push this thing? Could we do 4 million? Ooh, there's 4.6. How about 6 million IOPS, or 375,000 per server? So if I've whet your appetite, I hope you check out a bunch. We have a ton of storage sessions this week from Klaus, Cosmos, Ned, Eldon, the whole team is here, and they go into excruciating detail on how all of these tests were performed and how these tests really show off what we're doing in Windows Server 2016. So one thing to point out, of course, is we want to make sure whether you build this yourself, we want to make sure that we have partner-led solutions available as well from Dataon, from Dell, from Inspur, Intel, NEC, Hewlett-Packard, all of our partners. We are really thankful to have all of them, and they're doing some fantastic work. You're going to see a whole bunch of solutions come to market. Not sure what just happened there. So when it comes to storage, we've done a bunch of work here. Storage Spaces Direct has been really critical on building on what we've done in 2012 and 2012 R2, not with just storage spaces, but then adding RDMA, then adding additional capabilities to enable new deployment models. One of the things, of course, that was critical to this was storage quality of service. Okay? If you deploy a whole bunch of VMs, and one of them is your print server, one of them is your SQL server, guess what? I never want my SQL server to be starved of I/O. By the way, we actually do minimums and maximums, not just maximums. We're doing the real deal when it comes to storage quality of service. In addition, with Storage Spaces Direct, we want to really embrace new types of deployment models like hyperconverged. So hyperconverged has definitely been one of the hottest things everyone's been talking about. And hyperconverged, I think people just like saying the word, by the way. It's just a cool word that rolls off your tongue, hyperconverged. It's really just a fancy way of saying I'm running my hypervisor and I'm running my storage on the same server. And then I'm replicating all of those writes to two other servers. That's how hyperconverged works. Well, we've known about this because, spoiler alert, this is how we do storage up in Azure. Azure doesn't use SANs. Azure uses standard servers with built-in plug-in disks. And guess what? When we do a write on Azure, we're actually writing to three locations simultaneously in three different fault domains. So if any one of them goes down, that's okay. We detect the fault and begin a third write to a new location. Guess what? We're bringing that architecture, that insight from what we've been doing in our public cloud down into storage spaces and storage spaces direct. We also support, of course, the disaggregated model. So if you want to have a separate tier for your compute and a separate tier for your storage, you can do that. Personally, to me, when I look at both of these, hyperconverged is really nice for smaller deployments. You want to do 4, 8, 16 nodes? That makes all the sense in the world. But if you need to do something bigger, 50, 100, 200, no, you're not doing hyperconverged. You are doing the disaggregated approach. And the reason why is really simple. Because on the right-hand side with disaggregated, it gives you the ability to scale each of these tiers independently. If you go compute bound, plug in another server, turn it on, it joins the cluster, and oh, guess what? You now have the ability to take advantage of that compute memory. Oh, you need more I/O, or you need more capacity? Great, plug in another server in the storage tier, and guess what? We'll automatically load balance and rebalance without you doing anything. So that's all there as well. Both solutions, totally supported. Do what makes sense for you. And if you have any questions, please come by the booth. Happy to do that. I'm going to pass right by this slide because I've already chatted a little bit about RDMA. The important thing to understand is with RDMA, as I mentioned, when you do those writes, we have to write across multiple servers. With RDMA, that's pretty much free. If I don't use RDMA on a 10 gig infrastructure, I'm consuming at least 2 cores per server, which is going to impact your VM performance, your VM density, and your VM scale. If you're using RDMA with Hyper-V, you won't see it. So, moving right along, applications. I told you, I'm moving pretty quickly here. All right, application platform. A ton of work that we've been doing here to understand what's going on in the dev space as we start to do more and more to embrace new types of application models. Sure, we've been deploying things in virtual machines for a long time. Everybody knows how to do it. Yeah, you take a full operating system, you take a full application, you stick it in there, you go to town. Developers, guess what? They're not interested in VMs anymore. You ask a developer what they want, they're not going to say VM. I hate to tell you this. They want containers. They want lightweight stuff. They want endpoints. They want speed. They want agility. Containers give them that. So let's talk about what that really means. Let's talk about app innovation in Server 2016. We've been focused on three areas. Number one, we want to take your existing apps today that you have, and if you just move them to 2016, you're just going to get better security, period. Because you're going to get remote credential guard, you're going to get credential guard, you're going to get device guard, you're going to get code integrity, you're going to get anti-malware, you're going to get threat resistance, you're going to get a whole bunch of capabilities just by moving it into 2016. Second, you can evolve existing apps with new technologies. So if you have line of business applications that are important to move forward, guess what? We want to make it easy for you to take them forward, containerize them, start using DevOps models that are going to make your developers really happy. And then, of course, giving you innovation that's going to make it easy for developers to create new cloud-native apps. So, if we look at existing apps that exist today, I've got ones that are running in VMs. Yep, you know, those just work. They run in VMs. That's very IT pro focused, okay? Then we have the second one, the containerized app. What if we took our existing line of business .NET application and we actually containerized it, and guess what? Now, from a development standpoint, we can probably develop faster. And I'll talk more about that in just a second. And then new apps are really developer-focused. The developer wants to think, what is the thing that allows me to iterate on my application as quickly as possible to drive more value back to the organization? At the end of the day, that is what DevOps is. DevOps is a maniacal focus of the developer to deliver the best experience and the best applications to the end user, to delight them. That's what DevOps is. It's about that focus to get to that as quickly as possible and make customers happy. So, containers. Containers are a funny thing. With containers, honestly, I feel like we're talking about virtualization, and it's 2003 again. I remember in 2003, VMs came out, and everybody said, well, these are kind of interesting. They're kind of cool. Great for test dev. But we'll never use those in production, right? Anybody remember saying that? Anybody? I remember hearing it. Oh, Jeff, that's cute. That virtualization stuff's real cute. But no one's going to run their data center on it. It's how we run the world now. Azure? Anybody watch the Rio Olympics? That's all delivered on Azure. Guess what undermines Azure? Windows Server, Hyper-V, all of our software-defined capabilities and technologies. That's what underlies it. And it runs great. Now, With virtualization, we actually take a virtual machine and actually make it look like a physical machine. We create a virtualized motherboard, processors, storage, NICs, things like that, so I can install an operating system, I can install my apps, and it just works. The nice thing about virtual machines is each one of them is very isolated. I can run DOS, Windows 3.1, 95, 98, NT, 2000, 2003, 2008 R2, Red Hat Linux, 2016, it all just works. And each one of those virtual machines is actually isolated in hardware because of the work that we've been doing with our partners in the hardware industry for so long. So everybody's comfortable with virtual machines. Now comes along containers, and I hear people making these really wacky statements that, oh, containers are going to kill VMs, VMs are dead. Or people saying the exact opposite, no, VMs are great, they're going to kill containers. And it's like, no, they're totally different. Totally different. It's not apples and oranges, it's apples and Toyota Tundras. They are totally two different things, okay? They are both great. You can use them separately, you can use them together, but they are very, very different, so please stop conflating the two. What is a container? At its core, a container is operating system virtualization. Yeah, I actually said the word virtualization, but it's a different type of virtualization. It's a different type of abstraction. Instead of virtualizing at the hardware layer, what did we do? We actually moved up and we're virtualizing the kernel. We're abstracting the kernel away. We then take an application, put it in a container, and each one of these containers talks to the shared kernel. So when I deploy three containers, each one of them is talking to the shared kernel. They can't see each other. Each one of them has its own view of the file system. Each view has its own view of the registry. They are isolated in that manner, but they are talking to a shared kernel. Now, I have had people say, oh, Jeff, there's no security implications there. Well, you shouldn't say that either. I'm not going to get down on containers, but there are things that you could do that could inadvertently impact another container. Let me give you an example. You take a database, and you put it in a container, and you say, I want this thing to run really, really fast. Fantastic. Developer 2 creates a container. But you know what? This is an application that's super lightweight. It's super lightly loaded. It's going to run like maybe once or twice every quarter. What I'm going to do is when this thing is running, I'm going to put the system in the low power mode. Totally valid thing to do. So I now deploy this container, and now all of a sudden my database performance is inadvertently affected because I just put the system in the low power mode. Whoa, wait a minute. So again, the isolation is different. It's not to say that it's bad, but it's different. So we looked at this and we said, well, this is cool. We get it. We understand why people are doing this. But what is the problem that containers actually solve? Well, one of them it solves is the impedance mismatch between IT and devs. And let me walk you through a scenario because this really, I had a number of people, I did this in a previous session, a number of people said to me, that like turned the light on for me. So I'm Jeff, I'm a developer, I'm at my desk. I'm writing a new application. This application is exactly what the company needs. It's got an executable, it's got libraries, it's got frameworks, it's got shared DLLs, it is spectacular, it is my Mona Lisa. Once I release this, I'm gonna get a massive raise, I'm gonna take the trip and family on a vacation, it's gonna be spectacular. It deploys, I compile it perfectly every morning, and it just runs perfectly on my laptop. I am now giving it to IT. IT, please run this Mona Lisa of an application. IT says, oh, we'd be delighted, no problem. Look at the application, and I run the installer, and I go through the installation process. Doesn't work. What? Doesn't work. I send an email, get on the phone, hey, we can't get it to install. We can't get it to run. What's going on? I don't know. It runs perfectly on my laptop every day. Something must be going on. Check the installation, check log files, send me some data, let me know. Okay, let me try it again. And God bless IT. One thing I've noticed. IT, you guys have the patience of Job. If we gave you a manual 500 pages thick, you guys will sit there until it's done. Developers have none of that. If it's not working in 5 minutes flat, I'm off to something new. There's a very different pain tolerance between devs and IT. It's very true. So now IT does it again, and you know what? It still doesn't work. Hey, you know what, developer, sorry, your app still doesn't work. Well, now the developer who has spent like the last year and a half working on this is ticked. I'm calling up his boss. Okay, you know what? You guys need to get off the schneid because I have application perfection over here, and you guys can't even install. Manager calls up IT and says, listen, We have a very upset developer. Just make him happy. Do whatever he needs. Do whatever he asks. Just make him happy. This is a really important project. We all are going to lose our bonuses if this app doesn't get deployed. Okay, so IT, developer, what can I do for you? How can we fix this? Developer says, give me full admin access to the server. Oh, you all got it, didn't you? Oh, no! Yeah, exactly. But he was told to make it happen. Okay, here you go. Developer logs in. Oh, well, here's the problem. You're missing this framework. You're running an old version of this. Oh, these DLLs are missing. Oh, well, and you forgot these symbols over here. Okay, great. Oh, and I got to run these scripts. Great. Here you go. Works perfect, just like I told you. See? IT looks at this and goes, what is this? It looks like nothing in my infrastructure. I gave him a golden image, and I have no idea what I got. I got a brown image in return. I don't understand this. So what ends up happening is he deploys it, and guess what? I'm never going to touch that again. I'm going to leave it over a corner, and I'm just going to pray it never goes down. And 10 years later, when someone goes, what's that server? You go, I have no idea. Y'all been there, huh? Been there, done that, bought the t-shirt, yeah? Yeah. Here's how containers change this. I'm a developer. I write the application. This is fantastic. I'm going to get a huge raise. It's got an executable. It's got libraries. It's got shared DLLs. It's got frameworks. It's got scripts. It's got everything. It is perfection. I package this up into a container, and I give it to IT. I say, IT, please deploy this. IT says, Docker run. Just works. There was no installer. There was no MSI. No, everything was self-contained inside of that container. What the developer gave me and what I ran were exactly the same. This is why containers are super important. Because now what we're saying is there is one version of the truth. And guess what? It gets even better. So in the past, you would have double-clicked on an MSI and you would have run an installer. And when you needed to get a new version, you'd run an uninstaller or, heaven forbid, do a patch or something. And who knows what's going on in the registry and how that's, you know, stuff's being spewed all over the place. With a container, you say, developer says, you know what? I fixed a bad bug. Here's a new container. IT says, let me stop the container, let me put it over here in the library, and let me Docker run new container. Done. And to the OS below, it's all pristine because it's all in this container. That is what containers are trying to solve. It's this mismatch. It's this impedance mismatch between dev and IT. So we looked at containers, and a bunch of interesting things we noticed. We noticed that as people were playing with containers in the open source world, they would take a container and they would put it in a VM and they would deploy one container per VM. Wait a minute, that doesn't sound very efficient. Why are you guys doing that? That seems kind of crazy. Well, because we need isolation. When we talked to the compliance and regulatory people, I said, hey, containers are the new hot thing. They're in Linux, open source is using them. We've got them coming out in Windows Server. What do you think of those? And the regulatory compliance said, oh yeah, we hate those. What? Reason why was real simple. You said the words shared and kernel, Jeff. I'm not interested in that. You don't come to a compliance and regulatory guy and say the word shared and kernel in the same sentence. They run screaming out of the room. So we said, you know what? We hear you. We're going to deliver two types of containers. The first one, Windows Server container, is very analogous to what's going on in the open source world. When you deploy a Linux container, and by the way, I should mention, a container is a feature of the operating system. I know everybody's trying to take credit for it. It's actually a feature of the OS. Okay? Windows Server has them, Red Hat has them, SUSE has them. Docker makes fantastic management tools that help you package these up, that helps you create them, and things like Swarm, which does management. But the actual container technology is a feature of the OS, which is why Windows Server containers come from Microsoft. At the same time, we said, no, no, we want to help make it easier to deploy containers and provide enterprise isolation, so we also introduced Hyper-V containers. When you deploy a Hyper-V container, first of all, from a developer perspective, this is really important. When you create a container for Windows Server and Hyper-V containers, they are exactly the same. There are no differences. You tell your developer, go create a container. That's it. When you deploy it at runtime, that's when you specify, is it Windows Server container or a Hyper-V container? If it's a Windows Server container, then guess what? Yes, it uses the shared kernel. And that's fine if you're running it on your own infrastructure and you're comfortable with that. You know all the tenants, or maybe it's test dev, or if it's even production, but you know all the other tenants on there, great. Hyper-V containers, when you deploy that, we actually don't use a shared kernel. We use its own kernel. And guess what? We put up the Hyper-V shields and we give you virtualization isolation. Now you can run this in a public cloud, in a multi-tenant environment, in a hostile environment. You can run it internally in enterprise. If you're in a compliance and regulatory world, guess what? You just tell them, I'm running Hyper-V containers, and they'll go, oh, you're good. Because you're using hardware virtualization. So we did them both. Now, I already ran through the scenario. I kind of explained what that whole workflow looked like. So I'm going to go right on past that. And I want to point out the Docker partnership. You probably heard the big announcement. We're continuing a really great relationship with the folks at Docker. Love what they're doing. A lot of people ask me, what is Docker? You just said that the containers are a feature of the OS. Yes, it is a feature of the OS. But what the Docker guys do is provide these fantastic tools that allow us to create containers, package containers, do all of the things that you need to do to make containers usable. It's really, really great. And the beautiful thing about it is, if you're using containers in the Linux world on open source, guess what? Those same exact tools with no changes work with Windows Server containers and Hyper-V containers. We wanted to make it simple because we know going forward, people are going to mix and match. They're going to say, I really want to use SQL as my database, but I want to use, you know, some open source framework here. I want to be able to mix and match, and guess what? With Docker containers, not a problem. Because Docker allows me to use the same tools for both. And again, both runtimes. And I mentioned Docker makes management tools, but let's not forget also you can use PowerShell for management, you can use Kubernetes, you can use Swarm, you can use Mesos. In fact, the Azure Container Service is based on Mesos, another open source container management. So, orchestration, I should say. Finally, what are you going to run in the container? That's when we get to NanoServer. NanoServer is really just an FOS. And think about the one on the left. That's the full enchilada Windows Server. That is browser, Internet Explorer, a full desktop GUI. And the reason why we do that is because, honestly, there are some people that literally have a single server in a single location. Sometimes it's a school. Sometimes it's just a small business. And you know what? They need a GUI. That's the only machine they got. So that's why we do that. Server Core is how we've been recommending people deploy for a long time. Server Core, you take out the GUI, you take out the shell, it still has all the roles and features though. That's why it's still actually quite large at 5.4 gigabytes on disk, because it has Active Directory, Hyper-V, file, print. Yes, even the fax server is still there. I know, it's 2016 and we're still shipping a fax server. For crying out loud, I tried to get rid of it last time and people with pitchforks and torches came after me. So we left it in there and it's in 2016. I can tell you right now, I'm not taking it forward anymore. So get your fax loving out now if you're really still using it. So Server Core is there. And then of course now we have NanoServer. Now NanoServer, honestly, this isn't to scale because NanoServer is ridiculously small. It goes from 9 gigabytes on full to 5.5 gigabytes on Server Core to 460 megabytes for NanoServer. Yes, I said the word megabytes. For you younger folks out there, a megabyte is smaller than a gigabyte. A lot of folks don't even know what a megabyte is when you start talking about operating systems. I got to explain that. NanoServer is the optimized kernel. There are no roles, there are no features pre-installed. That's what makes this different from Server Core. Server Core still had all the roles and features. So even though, for example, you weren't using the fax role, it was there on disk taking up space. NanoServer is just the optimized kernel and you do the exact opposite. You say, I want this to be a Hyper-V server, I apply the Hyper-V bits. I want this to run in a container grid, I apply .NET. Or if I want to run Node, or if I want to run the mean stack, fantastic. Nano was a fantastic way to do that. If you want to manage it, it's remotely managed. Now, I'll be very clear here. We're not saying that it's all PowerShell and it's all CLI. No, we're still giving you a graphical management for Nano. It's just remote. That's all we're saying. And there literally is nothing to log into. There's just an emergency console if you actually misconfigure a network and you actually need to go change a network setting. That's all that it does. You can't do any more than that. You're going to manage it remotely using Server Manager, Hyper-V Manager, or using our server management tools. If you'll notice on the left-hand side, that beautiful blue GUI there, that's actually running on Azure, and it's all touch-friendly HTML5, and I can actually manage my Nano servers all up there using server management tools. Finally, we got some feedback from you throughout this development process. We've been listening very closely. People have been trying to deploy Nano, and they said, guys, this is really hard. You know, in Windows Server and Server Core, I just put in a disk and I run through an installer. Nano Server actually has no installer. It's not available when you go through the wizard and when you put in a disk. Yeah, because you actually do an image-based deployment. So we said, you know what, you are totally right, let's make this easier. So with the Nano Server Image Builder, you can run this like on your laptop, you can on your Surface, on any device. It's a real tiny tool and allows you to create and build your customized image. So you create the new image and then you can actually apply it to a USB key, put it in your USB key, boot up your server and install it in just moments. So you select the packages. For example, if I wanted this to be Hyper-V, I'd check the Hyper-V and I check failover clustering. And then when I'm done, it actually will create the image. I get the PowerShell below, so if I want to automate this and make not only one but dozens of these, not a problem. That's how we do Nano. Last thing, and I'm done, is servicing. I told you I had a ton of content, folks. Servicing, really quickly. A lot of people have asked me, hey, has Server 2016 in any way, shape, or form changed its servicing? No, not really, no. If you're using Server with Desktop Experience or Server Core, the way we've been shipping Windows Server for like forever, it's still the same, 5+5. Nothing has changed there. No concerns, please don't freak out. Nothing has changed. On the new node, though, is Nano Server. Nano Server is new and different, so this is not a change because it has never existed before. This is a current branch for business, which means this thing we want to be able to update very quickly and very easily, because honestly, we want to listen to your feedback. We want to understand if there are any blockers, anything preventing you from installing or building apps that you need, and we want to be able to make those changes really quickly and iterate on Nano very quickly. So understand that's what's going on with Nano Server. So with that, next steps. First, go make sure you go by the booth, experience HoloLens, check out the Nano Man at the booth. Come by the booth, talk to us about Nano Server. Get the eval bits. You should be playing with Hyper-V. You should be playing the software-defined storage. You should be playing with Nano Server, containers, all of these great things. Don't forget that Hyper-V containers exist in Windows 10 Anniversary Update right now. If you're running Windows 10 Anniversary Update right now, you actually have Hyper-V containers that you can actually create on your laptop, create on your Surface, and deploy on Windows Server 2016 with no code change. And with that, I am done. Thank you guys very, very much. Please fill out the eval. If you enjoyed this, my name was Jeff Woolsey. If you didn't, my name is Ben Armstrong. That's A-R-M-S-T-R-O-N-G. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the time.